Thanks for listening to the podcast. Stay connected on Facebook/ IFBB Ben PAK fan page, on Twitter at IFBB Ben PAK, and of course, BenPakulski.com.
All right, what's up, everybody? Muscle Expert Podcast number 5. Mr. Meadows in the house. And we're going to give you guys some insights on our 3-day training expedition together and with Mr. Dave Tate of EliteFTS.com and whatever else John wants to throw at you guys today. I got some cool stuff going on that I can share and always trying to share some info, which I also spent a couple of days out with Tom Purvis in Oklahoma and love to share the info there because I literally had my mind blown many times. So, John, what's going on?
Oh, just enjoying a nice Monday. I say Monday, but really every day is a Friday for me. My my corporate days are over, so I don't think in terms of Monday being day one. Every day is Friday, so things are good.
Good stuff, man. Yeah, you know what? Likewise for me, sometimes I don't even pay attention to what day of the week it is. it's all kind of Groundhog Day. You know, you get up, you eat, you train, you eat, sleep, you train. Kind of the same thing for me, so.
My week is day one is the day I go to Elite FTS, and then I just base everything off that. So my next, I know that there's like 5 days until Elite FTS, 4 days, 3 days, 2 days, 1 day. So it's D day at Elite FTS, and then T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. That's how my calendar.
That's awesome. So, man, I mean, obviously I know what it is, and all of your followers know what Elite FTS is, but for the people that may not know what that is, why don't you tell them about the awesomeness that is Elite FTS?
Well, you know, it's interesting because it's a powerlifting-based gym, but it's really taken off in the bodybuilding community. It's not an open gym where you can just come in and buy a membership. It's actually Dave's. Really, it's kind of his personal gym. It's I think Dave has it to show people various pieces of equipment and so forth. But really, it's just his personal gym, and it's in a warehouse. It's really fun. You know, you drive through what looks like to be a normal neighborhood, and then you pull up to this big warehouse, and it's basically all the equipment in this big warehouse. And you know, it gets hot in the summer, it gets cold in the winter, and but it's you know, your typical, you know, loud music as loud as we want to play it, and certainly everything you would need to train hard, and you know, you don't have to worry about making too much noise. But it's just a great atmosphere. People come into town. You know, I have people come into town frequently that I think have earned the opportunity to go there. You know, a place like that, I think you have to kind of earn the opportunity to go there.
Damn right.
it's, you know what I mean? It's not something where just anybody should just pop in. That's part of the appeal of it, is it's, you know, it's awesome. When people go there, they know it's something special. And when they leave, you know, their first question is always, when can I come back? So.
Right. Yeah, that's my first question. Yeah, so basically for everybody listening to this podcast, it's the exact gym that all of our listeners would dream of. Like, I think everybody listening to this is like, that's exactly what I want in my backyard or in my garage, you know, except it's massive and awesome and has 10 of everything you could possibly want and, you know, extremely well-equipped with an awesome atmosphere. Yeah, I mean, I was there 3 days and – I can't say enough about, you know, training with yourself and training with Dave Tate. For those of you that don't know Dave, he's a world champion powerlifter and now the owner of EliteFTS.com, which is probably one of, if not the best resources on the internet for equipment, information, and clothing, all the training-related supplements and everything. Pretty awesome site. I buy all my stuff off there personally sometimes, you know, with the equipment or shirts or you know, I just bought some bands off there this week. Dave's got a sale going on. So, yeah, what a great resource and what a great time I had, man. So thank you very much, John. I appreciate that.
Yeah, we loved it.
So what else is going on, man? How's training been since I left? Have you been putting the hammer down or what? Putting pedal to the metal?
Yeah, absolutely. so today was kind of an odd day. I just felt really, really good today. Like like I hadn't trained in a month. My recuperation, my central nervous system, I just felt awesome. So I took that as an opportunity to train a little bit more. I originally planned on just doing shoulders and triceps today, but I threw in some legs. I threw in some more back, which I pounded on Saturday. I threw in some hamstring, you know, some calves. So I did a lot of different things, a little more instinctual. But, you know, I'm getting into the phase now where I've been hitting 4 days, which is my kind of my standard off season for the first 3 to 5 months after a contest. And then I start adding to it. So I can feel myself going to the 5 day approach now. And one of the things I've done since you left is I've actually done a little bit of back work. And back would be my weakest body part. I'm sure everybody listening knows that. But I've actually done a little bit of back with every single time I've trained. You know, I've picked a movement. It might be a dumbbell row. It might be chin-ups on the chin-up assisted machine, which I happen to like a lot. Those assist machines, you know, they get a bad rap. It's kind of like the Smith machine. People are just like, oh, you know, just do regular chin-ups or just do regular dips. But, you know, you can use those assist machines to place you in a position where you can execute perfect form, especially on the chin-up, perfect form through the whole range of motion. So I really like those machines. And, you know, today I actually did a bunch of dumbbell rows. Saturday was a back day. The day before that, when I was in there, I did a ton of those chins on that machine. So I haven't got to the do my back twice in a day yet, just because of scheduling difficulty with my workload. But I am upping the amount of work that I'm giving my back, and it feels really good. It's not getting sore at all. So it's feeling great. It's adapting well. And so I'm going to continue to do that and push it a little bit harder and harder and harder as we go.
Awesome, man. I'm looking forward to seeing the results. And similar for me, actually, since leaving Elite FTS and you know, a couple of days there with you, it's really stimulated my brain and motivated me to research even more, man. I've been diving into the books and diving into the websites. But believe it or not, and the thing that I'm most curious about after spending a few days with you is supplementation. So I've been diving into so many different things to try to find, you know, maybe the right answer if it exists. And, you know, I've really been discovering some cool stuff, and I look forward to sharing it on our podcast perhaps next week or in a couple weeks. You know, for those of you that don't know, John is a Brent cyclic dextrin and dientripeptide kind of guy, whereas Ben is always a, you know, a carb ion, high molecular weight carb and a BCA guy. So, much as to most people, that doesn't sound like a massive difference, even if you don't know what you're talking about. We're talking about intra and pre-workout, even post-workout nutrition, and what is optimal. And for guys at our level, you know, if John's doing something that's 5% better than what I'm doing, even if it's 2% better, I need to know that. I need to figure it out and utilize it. So that 2% makes a big difference. So I've been snooping around, man. How's the you still pretty sold on your dientripeptides?
I am, and you know, here's the whole, I've thought a lot about this lately, because there's been so much debate on intra workout nutrition and really this kind of this whole window of opportunity. And I've seen people on both sides that I have a tremendous amount of respect for kind of disagree with each other. And here's where I think people are missing the boat. You have to look at it in context. You know, if you have a beginner that's just starting to work out, that's way too deep. That's not something I would even really talk about with a beginner. You know, learn how to train, learn how to eat good meals. You know, then as you work up into the intermediate stage, you know, then is it a value? Well, maybe a little. But here's where I think the value is. You know, people look at all these studies, and my problem has always been most of the studies looked at one side of the equation, which was muscle protein synthesis. There hasn't been a ton of studies that looked at muscle protein breakdown. And the ones that did, I've heard people reference them, and I've looked at them, and it would support the view that it doesn't really make a big difference when you take your carbs. That's what those studies say. And I disagree. for the population that trains the way we do. When you are just destroying muscle, there's a level of muscle protein breakdown that greatly exceeds what these studies are looking into.
Yeah.
And I would be willing to bet a tremendous amount of money that if somebody did a study, for instance, on what you and I did when you were here, and the effect that we had from an intra-workout supplementation, they would see some really cool things happening. Now, you know, trying to minimize that level of muscle protein breakdown, in my opinion, is a good thing. You can't, you know, I've heard people say, well, you don't want to eliminate it. You don't want to eliminate the inflammatory effect. You can't. You know, when you train that hard, you can't eliminate it. You just try to control it. And when you control it, I think there's an indirect effect on your central nervous system, your joints. You just feel better. You feel more recuperated. And, you know, so the question becomes, what are the right substances? Because I think a lot of the stuff out there, it doesn't give you really any bang for the buck. I mean, you know, you take a look at proven things, like creatine is proven, but is it going to really help you repair the way we're talking about? I don't think so.
Right.
I think the supplements that you mentioned, the branched cyclic dextrin, and, you know, the other one that's really good is Vitargo. Both of those are really low osmolality.
Right.
We kind of talked about that when you were here. Yeah. People will look at kind of that high molecular weight of the equation. That's part of it. But then the other part of it is how quickly can you get it to clear?
Yep.
And then so then you have that side of it, kind of the carb side of it. And then you have the protein side of it. And, you know, so what's best there, BCAAs, essential aminos, dientripeptides. And, you know, what I have people do is I take the cheapest routes first. And if it works, great. If it doesn't, then I'm moving kind of to the more expensive stuff, which is the dientripeptides and so forth. Because, you know, I understand we all have budgets and we don't want to spend a ton of money on supplements. I get that. But when you're in a situation like you and I are and you're training at this level of intensity, I think you can kind of throw the studies out the window and you just look and feel, does this work for me? If it does, great. If it doesn't, then that's fine too. But I've yet to find people, you know, I've yet to find somebody who said that their recovery isn't impacted by the strategy. So I don't think it's smoke and mirrors. I think it's real. I just think you have to apply it to the right population. You know what I mean?
Exactly right, man. Context is everything. I say that to everybody. I just got off a call. So, I mean, you know, I always kind of boast about the random resources I have. So I got off a call this morning with a gentleman, and literally the topic was exactly what we're talking about. So it's so perfect. His suggestion, he actually is a clinical pharmacology something or other. You know, he's basically a huge geek who knows everything about what's going on inside the body. His suggestion was the next level of recovery is exactly what you say, inhibiting protein breakdown as opposed to increasing protein synthesis. But his suggestion was actually delivery systems. So you could take the best supplements in the world, but if you don't have the optimal delivery system to get it into your cells, or it's not in the right format, perhaps you're not going to get the best results. And he suggested, you know, getting into things that are going to increase hydration to obviously allow your body to, you know, the more hydrated the muscle, the more protein is going to synthesize and hopefully less toxins in there and hopefully less protein breakdown. So that was his suggestion. You know, we're kind of all going to that same area of optimizing the pre-workout, the peri-workout, and the post-workout nutrition. And his suggestion was, he gave me some specific examples, which I won't mention right now, but I'll save that for a few weeks from now, how exactly to do that. You know, something as simple as adding electrolytes, something as simple as making sure you're optimally hydrated, may be a way to get another 5% out of, you know, your intra-workout or post-workout recovery protocol. Obviously, he went a little deeper than that, but, you know, it's such an interesting thing that, you know, we don't think about how we get it into the muscle. And we just kind of assume that, you know, maybe our body's going to pull it into the muscle because it's supposed to. But if we can enhance its uptake by, you know, 10 or 20%, that's a massive difference at our level, right?
Yeah, Yeah, that's probably a year and a half, 2 years ago, I was talking to Tim Patterson, the guy that owns BioTest, about this. He was fanatical about the amount of electrolytes and the ratio of electrolytes and the amount of water that you use in drink. I mean, he was really they were using me as a guinea pig for some products, and he said, I need you to drink this exact amount of water. Let me know what you think, and then I'd do that for a week. And he'd say, okay, I want you to change this amount of water. He'd send me new powder. Long story short, is he was saying exactly what you're saying, and that is critical, critical in terms of delivery. So that's pretty cool to hear you say that.
Yeah, and the guy that I'm referring to, I think he would choose to remain nameless. It's literally there's not many guys that have a greater understanding. At least not guys that I've met have a greater understanding that's going on at a cell, what's going on at a cellular level. He just talks on a level that three quarters of the time I'm just kind of shaking my head and smiling and nodding. I'm like, Like half the time I'm like, what is he saying? I don't know what he's talking about. But just his understanding of pharmacology and supplementation and how to optimize delivery of these amazing supplements we're taking, it blows my mind. So I'm really excited to see what he comes up with. He's in the process of developing some new things. Like I say, when that stuff becomes available to the public, then obviously I'll make it known on the podcast and let everybody dive into that. Super, super cool, man. Post-workout and intra-workout is everything I've been doing. I mean, here's a little tidbit of what I've changed in the last 3 months compared to what I've been doing in the past is I've been doing at least 200 grams of carbs during my workout, sometimes 250, and then I'll do about another 150 to 200 afterwards, depending on how they train. I'm getting leaner. It's unbelievable. I'm getting bigger. And before, in the past, I'd be scared of doing 100 grams of carbs after my workout. And now I'm doing way more, really optimizing the insulin uptake or the glucose uptake because we're training so hard. Taking that amount of carbs during the workout just allows me to push harder and longer. And for whatever reason, is improving my body's ability to use glucose or glycogen. Any insight on that, man?
Yeah.
I see you do stuff like that already.
Yeah, well, this is another debate that you hear. Can muscle cells preferentially suck up glucose more than fat cells? And again, a lot of people would disagree with this, but my experience has been, yes, when you train really hard, and you trash your muscles, they absolutely suck up glucose. And there's a lot more mechanisms behind that. I mean, that's my simplistic view, but there are much, much smarter people that could probably talk about how that helps your metabolism actually. If I just look at kind of the 10,000 foot view and can your muscle cells suck up glucose better? Well, if that's happening, then you have less going into your fat cell and more going into your muscle cell. So very, very simplistic. That's certainly not a very intelligent explanation, but that's what I think is happening. And again, I think it's about context. The harder you train, the more beneficial this is. The less hard you train, the less this isn't going to help you at all. So again, it's about context. But yeah, exactly.
I'll tell you what, though, man, up until literally maybe not even a year ago, 6 months ago, I would take in, people would tell me to take in 150 or 200 grams of carbs post-workout. And I would get tired. I would get bloated. And often I would get fat. And I've literally been taking 200 during and 200 after lately, or maybe sometimes less after, depending on how I train. Like I say, I'm getting leaner. So there has to be something to it. And I haven't seen any research, but I'd be curious to hear what Dr. Serrano perhaps has to say, or maybe some of our other research junkies. Maybe Dr. Wilson will give us some insight on that maybe next week. It's why. It blows my mind. I mean, I'm taking in way more carbs than I ever have. I'm getting leaner. I used to be scared to eat carbohydrates because I'm like, well, if I eat too much, I'm going to get fat. My body's not using it. And now I'm really taking in twice as many and literally watching myself get leaner day to day. And I'm, walking around at 315 pounds, and it's not – I'm not shredded, but it's not terrible, So it's such an interesting thing, always learning. Even after 15 years of doing this, we're still learning something new.
Well, 2 years ago, I didn't want to recover that well. I thought that, you know, my red badge of courage was, you know, how sore I was, because I was essentially sore for 20 some years without a break. And I just thought, well, if I'm not sore, I didn't do enough. And
right.
It was just an eye-opening experience for me when I figured out there was a way I could improve my recovery and train more often. And I put 11 pounds of stage weight on 2 years ago. Then I put another six on last year. You know, and this is an old guy that's been doing this for almost 30 years. You know, so then I get a chance to work with some other guys. You know, you saw what happened with Dugdale. He would never even was scared to go over 4 days. You talk to him now, and he refuses to train less than seven because it works so well for him. And I got a guy, Ken Jackson, in Michigan that has gained 20 pounds, and he's leaner. He's got abs now at, you know, 275 that he didn't have at 255. And this is a, you know, 37, 38-year-old guy that's been at this a long time. So what I'm trying to say is people, you know, there's going to be a debate, but this is one of those things where you just know that nutrient timing done a certain way is going to be a difference maker. So now the question is, how do we just get this to function the absolute best possible? And we'll let us figure that out. I'll gladly be the guinea pig for it.
Well, and the truth of the matter is, man, there's never going to be an answer. It's always going to be such a varying degree of, as you said, context, right? There's never an answer because no one's ever going to train the same intensity. It's going to be variable for everybody. It's a matter of, you know, perhaps presenting a continuum and saying, here, figure out where you put on, where you fit yourself in, and go from there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, one of the cool things about working with a lot of people is I'll tell a lot of people, hey, let's experiment with this. Let's try this. Let's do this for 2 weeks, and then let's try this and do it for 2 weeks. And, you know, you definitely start to see some things happening that are patterns. And when you see patterns amongst a lot of people, you know, I don't think you can automatically say, well, this is a rule, this is exactly what happens, but it gives you some good insight into coaching people and gives you some good things that you can do with people to help them improve, and it gives you options. And, you know, Dr. Serrano is, incidentally, he's definitely the smartest person I've ever met or talked to in my life. And he is of the opinion that we can figure stuff out on our own very quickly if we just pay attention to what's going on, listen to our bodies. You know, to him, the biggest lab in the world in terms of building muscle is, you know, you can look at bodybuilding, for instance. You know, that is a huge experiment. That's a huge lab. The only part there is kind of the drug factor that you got to factor in, but you know, there's a lot of things if you just pay attention and learn and observe, you can get out in front of this stuff and figure out some pretty cool stuff. It's just being able to do that. And that's, you know, that's the trick.
I think one of the things you said there was more important than you're caring to realize is the fact that you're doing a 2 week experiment. So you're setting a time limit and you're literally just trying new stuff. And the problem that most people run into is why they don't really see progress or see gains is they just kind of try something and it becomes arbitrary. They don't really have a goal. They don't have a deadline. They just kind of throw it out and go, well, let's see what happens. You know, let's try something hard for 2 weeks, or let's try something hard for 4 weeks. And that's why most of the programs I design are between 4 and 6 weeks, because give someone a short-term definitive goal with an outcome. Like, this is what we're trying to do. Do it. You know, as opposed to go, well, you know, just go and follow this plan, or let's do it. A 5-month periodized plan. It's not a short-term, you know, objective. So I think when you set those short-term goals for yourself and you go, let's try this and see what happens, it gives you a definitive answer as opposed to throwing something out there and like, hey, I'm just going to try this supplement until the tub's gone. And the tub may last 4 weeks or it may last 4 days, you know, depending on who's taking it. So how can you really compare the two, right? So setting that protocol like you do, I think, is a lot more ingenious than you even realize, or maybe you do realize, just all let on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome. So getting into back training, man, I wanted to share a little bit of the stuff that I did with Purvis. So those of you that don't know, Tom Purvis is the gentleman who created RTS, RTS123.com. And, you know, we kind of dove into, spent 2 days out in Oklahoma, just diving into, you know, exactly how to train, understanding training, understanding what we're trying to accomplish, and really how to look at biomechanics and looking how the body is supposed to move and optimizing it for me and looking how to optimize it for other people. Man, I wish I would have gone to Oklahoma first and then come out to see you, and you and I could have brainstormed on the stuff, because some of the back training stuff that he showed me, or just the way that you look at back training, I think it's going to change my body. Like, you know, I've done 2 back workouts since, and I feel like a different person already. Just looking at it in the sense of, you'll understand this, in the sense of having the opposite type of strength curve that a press does, in the sense of, you know, press is supposed to be hardest when it's close to you and easiest as you push it away. You know, and then when we do a back movement, it gets progressively harder the closer you pull it to you. You're getting weaker and the weight is getting heavier. If that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so when we do like a barbell row or a dumbbell row, you know, the closer you pull that weight to you, the heavier it's actually getting, because it's getting further away from you, or at least it's getting further away from the axis because your arm is bending and the muscle is getting shorter. So technically what should be happening is we should start with a heavy weight at an extended position, and it should get progressively lighter as it comes towards into the short position, right?
Yeah.
Does that make sense? So, like, that would be the optimal way to train your back. And there really aren't any ways to do that. There's a few machines that have been, you know, properly designed with the right cams and such. And, you know, once I actually kind of understood that concept. So, obviously, you know, everybody's got a weak back. What is the thing that everybody in the world says for them to do? Heavier, 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 you know, bent rows, dumbbell rows, or, you know, all the basics, right? We'll stick with the basics. Do some pull-ups.
Yeah.
Right? And the suggestion was, well, why don't you spend more time in a contracted position where, with a weight you can actually handle there first? You know, because, I mean, I can do a 200-pound dumbbell row with relative strict form and not moving my body anywhere, but I'm never getting that muscle particularly short because my elbow is never really getting as far behind me as it's supposed to be, because that weight's getting heavier and that muscle's getting weaker, so it just doesn't want to go there. So
yeah.
Tom's suggestion was to figure out ways to train your muscle in the shortest position first, whether it be with machines or whether it be with perhaps, you know, doing a dumbbell row, you know, starting a little lighter and then just working the back half of the range first and then dropping that, grabbing something heavier, and then continuing the set in the lengthened part of the range. And doing stuff like that, just, you know, the idea of working muscle through its entire range, but with an appropriate load that you can actually get there and get a contraction.
Yeah.
And the difference in 2 days, this sounds ridiculous, but I see a difference and I feel a difference. You know, my soreness is great. The tightness is great. My ability to mentally contract has improved. And I'm almost like, this can't be real. It can't be happening that quickly. But if you look at it from a biomechanics standpoint, it makes perfect sense that it is happening that quickly.
Well, okay, so I think I might have done something Saturday that is, that wasn't my purpose, but unintentionally that mimicked that. So, and I think this will, so tell me if this is like, if this would apply. I got on the hammer strength row machine, and it's the one that we did at Dave's where,
yep,
for those of you who are listening, the low row.
Yep.
And I didn't go real heavy. I just said, I'm going to get elbows back as far as my active allow me. Usually,
yeah.
I might go up to 2, you know, maybe, I don't do those real heavy anyway, but I went even lighter, and I really focused on getting my elbows back, and I didn't really concern myself a whole lot with the stretch. I was more concerned
right.
with get your elbows back, and then I went to a pull down where I had a pretty heavy weight, but I only pulled it down halfway.
That's exactly it, man.
You know, I was only concerned about the stretch position, and I wasn't intentionally doing what you're talking about, but it sounds like I kind of did it by accident. But
yeah,
that was the combination I used, and I had an awesome pump in my lats.
Yeah, well, the idea being, you know, the weight you can use in an extended position, whether it be on a pull down or a bent row, it's pretty heavy. You know, like, it's probably a lot relative to what you can use in that really shortened position. So you need to break into 2 different exercises, really. I mean, you know, what I can do in a shortened position is probably half, if not less, of what I can do in a lengthened position. So, you know, hammer strength row that you speak of, figure out a weight you can do for 10 to 12 reps at the back of the range, getting full contraction, and then you can know you can go proportionally heavier in the lengthened part of the range, right? Whereas if you started trying to go super heavy in the lengthened part of the range, you would never be able to get back far enough because your muscles would just get weak and your body would start contorting or you'd start recruiting other muscles that aren't supposed to be helping.
Right.
So you're looking at it like that, and it's the same idea for biceps. Back and biceps have a similar type of strength profile. But, man, I mean, this may be over the heads of some of the people listening to this conversation, but it blew my mind. And the difference immediately in the contraction and understanding how to do it, I think it's going to be revolutionary, man. And if you looked at it, I mean, you looked at during Yuta's training as much as anybody. That machine that he did that he was famous for, the two of them, the pullover and the high row hammer strength, both perfectly mimic that type of strength curve, if you think about it, because it gets really heavy in the middle and then actually lightens off at the back.
Yeah, right.
So even though he didn't know he was doing it, he was doing it anyways. Right. So, I mean, really, really super heavy in the middle where you're strong. And then as you get, you know, behind you, where your elbow's kind of getting behind you, the weight starts getting less because it passes the midpoint of the movement or the midpoint of the machine. So, man, yeah, I mean, looking at that now, I'm analyzing everyone's movements on, I'm looking at YouTube videos and, you know, what's this person doing? How are they doing it? And why is their back so good? And how can we, take what we're seeing other people do and improve on it? And, I really believe that success leaves clues. Even most of these bodybuilders out there have no idea why they have strong body parts. If they have a strong body part, there's something about what they're doing that is right. Like the example I gave you when I was there was Kai Greene, right? Like, Kai may not have any, I've never really watched him train, but he may not have any idea why he has such an awesome back. But if you watch him train, something he's doing is going to give you an indication as to why his back is so great.
Yeah.
You know, you agree with that?
Yeah, I think you weigh in, you kind of factor in the genetic piece. And then I always like guys like Rich Gaspari, you know, Gaspari was kind of a narrow clavicle, large pelvic girdle guy like me that didn't have, he wasn't genetically blessed in terms of structure or muscle kind of fullness and volume that you see some of these kind of cartoony characters today. But he built a lot of muscle up, you know.
Right.
So I like to look at guys that like Tom Platz did in 1981, he was criticized for his upper body. Well, he brought in, his legs were easily better than everybody else at the Olympia that year. But guess what? His upper body was too. And he radically changed the way he looked. So there, I like to look at guys like that because I feel like they didn't benefit so much from genetics. But I definitely like to know what these other guys did so I can look at it. Like, I can look at what Lee Haney did for his back, and I've tried it a million times, and I've got zero results. But I might look at what Ronnie Coleman did, and it might work for me. So I do believe that you should evaluate it, but I think you kind of, when you look factor in the genetics, you kind of just weigh that into your thoughts as well.
Of course. Here's my thought. When I look at a guy who has an obscene genetic body part, like let's look at Tom Platz's legs, there's something about the way, yes, it's genetic, it's 100% genetic, but it's something about the way his body naturally puts force through that muscle, or something about the way the body naturally sits on that muscle, or something to do with their posture, or their pelvic tilt, or something about the length of their levers or something in their genetic makeup that makes them have a tremendous affinity for building that muscle. But I think Kai Greene's benefit is, when I refer to his back, he puts a ridiculous amount of tension through his back, but he's also tremendously inclined to getting his shoulders retracted and his elbows extended extremely far behind his back, more so than anyone else you could ever observe.
Yeah.
So that right there, I'm like, okay, well, there's something to that, right? Like, that can give you an indication. Or if you were to watch perhaps the way I were to train my quads, there may be something in that analysis of movement that goes, oh, well, maybe he's poking his pelvis this way, or maybe he's doing that. Of course, my lever length is going to have a major component of it, but, you know, there may be something to the way Ronnie Coleman trains his arms that can give you an indication of, you know, what is he doing here naturally that he's clearly not thinking about? What is his body naturally inclined to do that gives him this massive body part? Like watching Dennis James train chest and shoulders. I learned a lot because I looked at his movement and I was like, he doesn't know what he's doing, but his body knows what he's doing. I mean, his body's figured out what works really well for him and how to do it, and this is what's going to work. So maybe there's a reason why he has these massive body parts that has more to do with just, you know, quote-unquote genetics, the ability to build it. Because I don't believe genetics is necessarily the ability to build a muscle so much as it is for your body's natural tendency to put force easily through that muscle, right?
Well, you know, Dennis James, it does. Dennis James was funny because I remember seeing him do incline barbell presses. Of course, he had that massive upper chest, shoulder girdle. And I remember him cutting his rep short about 2 or 3 inches from touching his chest. And at the time, I was a fervent, you got to touch your chest when you do incline barbell presses. And consequently, I always had really sore rotators. And when I saw him train, I just said, you know what? Daggone it. Dennis James does it. I'm going to try it. And that was actually one of the key influences on why I don't take the bar all the way down to my chest. And I let my elbows travel at a certain angle when I train that particular movement, inclines, was actually what I saw him do. So I said, you know what? I'm going to try this. Because he's big, he's massive, so damn it, I'm going to try it and see if it works for me. And it did. It worked really well. My shoulder improved tremendously, my chest and sugar. I don't know that it really increased or decreased the weight I was using, but there was a level of tension that stayed on my chest and didn't go away. So, no, I get what you're saying, and as you were going through that description, I was thinking about Platts, too, you know, and he had this flexible, he was really limber in his hips, and he had a really flexible, like his Achilles tendon, like his ankle mobility, you know.
That's what I was going to say, yeah.
You know, so that lent him, that helped his movement pattern put stress in certain areas,
yeah.
Whereas it's harder for me because I don't have the exact same movement pattern. And so, yeah.
Of course,
I think
but maybe you could make it up synthetic. So that's exactly what I was thinking. I mean, he's probably got obscene dorsiflexion, right? So his ability to, like, bring his knee over his toe is probably ridiculous.
Yeah.
So, right. So how can you replicate that? I don't have that kind of range of motion either. Mine may be better than most people, but I don't have that kind of range of motion either. But maybe how can you replicate that? To benefit you. So maybe raising your heels an inch or two off the ground. So what that's going to do is change the distance from the knee joint to the floor and thereby allow your toes to travel further out, thereby somewhat replicating what Platts was doing. You see what I'm saying? That's kind of my thought. Like, there's got to be something in the way you have that body's placing tension on that muscle that'll give you a clue on how to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And you know what? I think that's kind of just kind of fun, too. I think it's pretty cool to go in the gym and just kind of, hey, you know what? I'm going to do this. I saw this guy do this. I think that's kind of fun, too. And, you know,
sure.
I go to the gym, and as hard as we work, it's fun. Man, it's a good time. And
yeah.
I know that's kind of probably irrelevant to the conversation, but I actually enjoy doing these kinds of things and thinking about it along those terms. It's just interesting, but
it's relevant and it's not like what you're saying there. Actually, I made a post about that on Facebook today. Was the idea of, you know, why don't you answer this question? I mean, you may be a special case, but you know, what's your favorite body part to train?
Oh boy,
you have one.
If I'm pre-contest, it's probably my chest because it actually looks good. But any other time of the year, it's my legs.
Okay, and now what's your least favorite body part to train?
I don't particularly like training arms.
Okay.
I actually do like training back, even though it's my weakest body part, because it forces me to think so damn much.
Right.
You know, so I can see where there have been times where I got so frustrated, I just said, I don't even want to train my back. It's a waste of time. And the same thing with my calves. There were times when I got so frustrated, I just said, this is pointless. But, and I think that's where a lot of people go mentally with weaker body parts. They just say, screw it, the heck with it.
Well, that's my point, right? That's my point is, you know, my strongest body part or my, I mean, let's say, it's called, I guess it's, let's call it spade a spade. My strongest body part is my legs. When I'm training my legs, my attitude is awesome. I'm cocky. I'm happy. I'm arrogant. I'm excited. I'm having fun. When I'm training my back or in the past, maybe my biceps in the past, I hate it. I used to always schedule my arm training on Saturday, and I'd go out and party on Friday night, and I wouldn't go on, like, this is when I was a kid. Or I just wouldn't go on Saturday. I'd go on Saturday and be like, oh, maybe I should do deadlifts instead today. I wouldn't do it because I hated it, and I wouldn't enjoy it because, you know, it's just something about it. It wasn't the same confident, happy attitude. And if you could perhaps train your brain to enjoy, you know, that training and that feeling and be happy to do it as opposed to being shitty about doing it, you know, that can make a big difference. And then my example may not be perfect, but, you know, the idea that when I'm doing my legs, I'm in my happy place, man. I'm like, no matter how much it hurts, I know I'm doing something great. I'm having fun. And then, you know, when you're doing your weaker body parts, your muscle doesn't just connect as well. And it doesn't feel as great. You don't get as, you know, pumped up and excited about it. So your attitude is different. And that may have something in itself to do with the development of the muscle, right?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, you're not feeling it as much. You're not enjoying it as much. You kind of go, forget it. I'm not going to do it.
Yeah, that's, you know, as I get older, the other part that fits into that equation is what doesn't hurt, you know? My elbows, you know, are probably my most beat up area on my body. And the thought of arm training, it's not real appealing to me because the way my elbows feel. And, you know, so that's another factor I think to kind of throw into the mix is keeping yourself healthy. And, you know, if a squat, this is why I always like leg curls before squats. It just makes my hips feel better, my knees feel better. It just makes it feel better. And there's nothing more demoralizing than getting fired up and heading to Elite FTS and getting in the squat rack. And as I'm squatting down, it doesn't feel right.
Right.
It sucks. It's like, man, I just drove here an hour expecting to feel awesome. And I'm ready to tear shit up. And now my joints don't feel right.
Yep.
You know, that's. So I think there's a whole other element here too. I'm probably getting completely off track, but I'm just talking about what's coming. Is you know, keeping your joints healthy, and that contributes also to kind of my mental state and how much I like training a body part or not.
Of course, I mean I had that exact scenario when I got to Elite this week and started warming up the legs. Felt pretty good, and then I got tight and just getting to the part just doesn't feel right. So just pissed off, and there's no other way to say it, right? Sucks.
Yeah, you know, and you put something up on Facebook a couple of days ago. I don't know when it was, but you put something about being strong through the entire range of motion. And mm-hmm. I read that, and I had an MAT appointment that day. And I went to my MAT appointment, and I said, okay, we need to figure out a way to get me stronger through a bigger range of motion in my back and through my lats specifically. And so this guy, he's really, really fun to work with. So he's like, okay, all right, let's do it. Let's figure it out. So, you know, what we're doing is I've got an idea what my active range of motion is, and he's going to try to do some work, you know, maybe with my shoulders and triceps that will allow that Ty Green-like contraction that you're talking about happen,
right.
You know, to be able to produce tension and you know, at a further range of motion. Now, those guys in MAT are really big on once you get past your active range of motion, you can actually cause some muscle inhibition, which when you see their treatment and you undergo their treatment, makes perfect sense to you. If you've never gone through it, it's harder to harder to understand, but when you've actually seen, you know, a forced stretch beyond your active range of motion, when you see how that shuts down muscles that are kind of on the edge, you know, I don't think it's probably not an issue for muscles that are nice and firing right, everything's connected. But when you get something that maybe isn't quite firing right, like maybe my lats, maybe they're not as efficient as other body parts, and then it makes a difference, you know. It makes me wonder, just weak part body parts in general, is there some kind of inhibition there for people that could be alleviated? I don't know. I mean, that's
100% there is, man. I mean, I don't think it's something that we can do ourselves. Like, I don't think if what you're saying is, you know, if you were to go to this really, really contracted range naturally, like doing a back movement, I don't think you could deactivate the muscle that way. But if you try to stretch it back there, you could probably deactivate it that way. You see what I'm saying?
Right. That's what I mean. That's exactly
what I mean.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah,
definitely, man. There's certainly thought about that. I mean, I know for a fact that my lats were just weak as a kitten in a fully shortened position up until maybe a year ago, or maybe a little more than that. But, like, week in, week out, doing these little activation exercises that people would probably laugh at me for doing for the small amount of weight and resistance I was using prior to training. And then you go and train, your contraction is improved, you know, 1,000%. Because all you're doing is you're cueing your nervous system, you're cueing your brain to say, hey, it's time to activate this muscle now, let's turn it on, as opposed to relaxing it. Whereas like a stretch will give your nervous system the cue to turn it off and lengthen and relax. You know, an activation will give your nervous system the cue to activate it and make it more receptive to load, right?
Yeah. Yeah, this whole I have a feeling that I'm going to spend a lot of time in the next 3 to 6 months researching this whole stretching thing, too, because I think there is tremendous value in doing it at certain times, but I don't think I'm educated on it enough to be able to speak to it and give it justice. I feel like doing pretty hard stretches a certain way when a muscle is fully pumped, it feels like it's extremely beneficial. And I'm trying to just figure out when, you know, what's counterproductive, what's productive. I just find myself drifting off into thinking about that a lot. You know how you get a subject, like I remember 3 years ago, I just got obsessed with the liver and I just studied the liver for like 3 months. And then something else came along and I studied that for like 3 months. But I feel myself kind of getting obsessed with stretching right now.
Yeah.
And this whole stretching and this whole active range of motion, how do you increase it? Kind of that whole area is, I can feel my brain headed there.
Yeah, man, that's, you know, what I've been doing for the last couple of years is that's RTS and that's MAT, right? And that's really what I've been studying probably since 2011. I'm just trying to get it because that seems to have the greatest implications when it comes to training out of anything I've discovered in my life. You know, understanding biomechanics, understanding what's supposed to happen at a muscle, you know, at the contractile level, and figuring out how to apply it to what we do. So, super interesting. And I don't think the answer exists, to be honest. I mean, again, Tom Purvis spoke about stretching and what his thoughts of it are and, you know, what value it has. And, you know, it just may not be doing what you think it is. And that's kind of the best way to look at it is people think, oh, it's going to improve my range of motion. It may not. You know, the first question is, well, why are you stretching? Okay, well, I'm stretching because I'm tight. Well, then the next question should be, why are you tight? Not how can I make it better, right? So, you know, if I'm tight, I may be tight for a reason. There's a good reason why your brain is going to make you tight. It's not just going to miraculously happen by accident. It's your brain sending a message to that muscle saying, hey, you need to be tight for some reason, perhaps protecting you, right? And now I'm going to go stretch it and give my nervous system the cue to relax. And maybe that's not the best idea. So, it's interesting, man. It's, I don't know that I'll ever have the answer, but I'll certainly enjoy trying to find out.
Yeah, and then we'll probably change our mind in 5 years anyway, so.
And, man, that makes you more – that's good. That's a good thing, right? I mean, so you're open to change, and that's – I mean, so important, I think, in everything. I mean, how many times have you changed your mind in the last 10 years?
Oh, yeah. People ask me what my philosophy is, and I tell them I stole this directly from Louis Simmons. Louis, you asked Louis this, and Louis would say, I don't have one. because that implies that I think I've got everything figured out and nothing's going to change. And I can tell you what the guys do at Westside Barbell now are vastly different than what we did when I was there in the 90s. I try to adopt that same attitude. You know, I have thoughts right now, but I'm not married to any of it. You show me a way that's better, and then I'm doing it. Because all I care about is hypertrophy, longevity, health. You know, those are the things I care about. I don't care about what gets me there. I just care about the end result and whatever it takes to make me more healthy, to give me longevity, to help me grow. Those are the things I'm going to do. So, you know.
And that's just what we're all after, right? I mean, we don't have the genetics that some of these guys are competing against do, and we're trying to make the most of it. And I think that's what makes us successful, that makes us relatable to other people is, you know, the guys we're competing against could literally do very minimal and be successful, or at least do things completely improperly and be very successful. I know I don't have that luxury, man. I do things properly. If I don't do things properly, I just simply won't grow. My body says, this is not going to happen. You know, like, sorry, dude. And thanks. Better luck next time. Keep moving on. It's not going to happen. You know, in the last couple of years, my growth has been exponential because I'm learning and I have much less injury and it seems like I don't have to work quite as hard to get the same results, which is encouraging.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, just imagine when you get to my age, man. Just imagine then how good you're going to be.
I'll probably be about 175 pounds when I'm your age, man. Who's kidding who? I don't think I have any intention of doing this till I'm 45 or anywhere near there. Really, probably by the time I'm 40, I'll be well past retired.
I'm pretty sure I said the exact same thing when I was your age.
Yeah, well, you know, we'll see. You never know. I mean, I love it, man. I don't ever want to stop. Just, you know how it is, man. You got a family, you got other opportunities coming up, and much as I, truly love what I do, you wonder if it's the right path and if, you know, there's other things you should be doing. So.
Yep, absolutely. Yep.
All right, man. I think that's going to wrap us up. We're coming to just over an hour, I think. So. Man, that was a great one as always, and no particular topic other than optimizing everything to do with training.
All right. It was fun. Until next time.
What's your website again, man? You want to drop your website for everybody in case they want to check out some of your stuff, read some of your info?
Yeah, it's mountaindogdiet.com, and I'm also on Facebook. I have a Mountain Dog Diet Facebook page, and I have a John Meadows personal page as well. And so look me up on there and see what you think.
You have any Instagram yet?
No, I haven't got – you know what, man? I'm just trying to figure out time. How do you – you know, I try to connect all these things, my YouTube channel to my Twitter, so that you only do it in one place. And
you want them to put all them, but it doesn't work with Instagram, unfortunately.
Yeah,
I wish
so
it did.
I've got to figure out how to do that on Instagram. That's kind of the last piece, but
I think people would love seeing you train at Elite, man. That place is like a mecca. So people would post pictures of you, Dave, and your training partners out there. They'd enjoy it.
Yeah, I'm going to have to do that. I think you're right.
You know, I'd enjoy seeing who comes out to train with you every couple of weeks, all your clients, all your friends. That's cool, man. You know, same with me. People are always like, who's coming out to train with you now? I'm like, oh, yeah, this person's coming. And to me, it's no big deal. Just like to you, it's no big deal. But to everybody else, they want to see, you know, what we're doing, and they want to see everybody lay on the ground after the workouts and all that stuff. So, yeah, man. Yeah. So, yeah, check out johnmountaindogdiet.com, and for me, it's benpokolsky/mi40.com. Benpokolsky.com/mi40, sorry. And that's it. Muscle Expert Podcast number 5, Mr. Meadows. Enjoy yourself, buddy, and have a great one.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Stay connected on Facebook/IFBB Ben PAK fan page, on Twitter @IFBB Ben PAK. And of course, BenPokolsky.com.